Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the issue of reparations is starting to become one for the 2020 Democratic presidential field. Candidates Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Julian Castro say they favor reparations in principle, but while all of the major candidates have embraced support for some kind of reparation policy for Black Americans over the legacy of slavery and much, much more, none of the candidates have a reparations proposal. And yet it's becoming one of the first issues that Democrats are willing to challenge each other on. Here's Bernie Sanders last month.
What do they mean? I'm not sure that anyone's very clear. What I've just said is that I think we must do everything that we can to address the massive level of disparity that exists in this country.
So that's Bernie Sanders saying he doesn't know what reparations mean last month. And here's Julian Castro responding to Sanders on CNN's State of the Union yesterday.
Let me just say something about Senator Sanders' response there, because he was also asked this question in 2016. Mm-hmm. What he said on The View, I think, the other day was that he didn't think the best way to address this was for the United States to write a check. To my mind, that may or may not be the best way to address it. However, it's interesting to me that when it comes to Medicare for All, health care, you know, the response there has been, we need to write a big check. That when it comes to tuition-free or debt-free college, the answer has been, we need to write a big check.
So what could a serious reparations policy look like, and how does that compare to the way the Democratic field is handling the issue? My next guest writes a lot about race and national policy and recently reparations, Brianna Gray, columnist and senior politics editor at The Intercept, and she joins us from South by Southwest in Austin, Texas right now, where among other things she interviewed Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over the weekend. Brianna, hi. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a report from the front there? I hear it's turning into quite the beauty pageant for Democratic presidential hopefuls.
That's right. You know, I've been kind of busy preparing for the AOC interview, but I have been able to watch some snippets and have spoken to other people who have attended some of the other interviews. And it's been a pretty comprehensive showing.
I realize you're on the beat that you're on, and other people are covering those candidates, but any buzz about sort of who's hot and who's not in their appearances?
Well, I did see during the Schultz interview, the Howard Schultz interview, a clip that I found to be kind of revealing, where he was asked about socialism, and he gave the rather pat and expected now line about Venezuela. And whereas I think a year or so ago, certainly several years ago, that would have gone over without a hitch, this time in front of this audience, there were groans of disapproval. I think that people have finally gotten hip to the idea that you can't take one isolated country with a discrete historical history that has a lot to do with U.S. interventionism as well, and use it as the sole prime exclusive example for how a political system can operate.
And we booked you last week to talk about your previous writing on reparations for today. But now that this weekend has passed, I read that your live interview of AOC drew more people than any other political event at South by Southwest, including any of the presidential hopefuls. So what's your own takeaway from talking to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
You know, the thing that I appreciate most about her, and I think what actually resonates most with people, despite all the headlines that were largely about Bill Nye, who was one of the people in the audience who ended up asking a question at the end. I think that the thing that comes across the most and what's most compelling is the extent to which she foregrounds humanity and morality in her politics. So she's able to convey in very simple terms an ideology that basically says that Americans have value, that humans who live in this country and all around the world have value, and that our politics should serve their interest before they serve any broader political interest. And she is unflinching in calling out, undemocratic influences, the influence of money in politics, in a way that's very frank, in a way that other politicians, I think, don't, because they are more personally implicated, perhaps. And I think that the audience respond to that as refreshing and honest and kind of common sense.
Wait, Bill Nye, the science guy, asked AOC a question at South by South. Those are two people you don't think of in the same breath.
Well, he was a very excited fan, from my observation of their interaction. He was in the questioning line with everybody else, and we ended up picking him for the last question, and the crowd went wild.
And his question was?
He asked her about fear. He said that he pointed out that he is a white man and that he thinks that a lot of frustration coming from his own demographic is about fear, and that I think the growing equality means that something has to be lost for white men. And what should we do about that? How should we handle that concern politically? And Representative Ocasio-Cortez's response was that we have to stop thinking of politics and pitching politics as a zero-sum game, and we have to help people understand that when all of the community is healthy, when one part of the community is healthy or made better or made more equal, it benefits everybody. And that the kind of politics, the Southern strategy that we've been living with now for decades, which pits low-income workers of different races against each other in an effort to preserve power at the top, we've got to speak about that more explicitly so that those narratives have less power.
Did you ask AOC about reparations?
You know, it came up a little bit in the conversation. I asked her, you know, what we should do, how we should rank our political priorities. You know, how can we ethically, and this is a question that I've struggled with myself, how can we ethically, I think a debt is owed, and that's uncontroversial, at least in my view, with respect to reparations. But if we are looking at candidates who have a political responsibility to all Americans, and we have to kind of pick and choose on some level what we're going to come in with, all guns firing, you know, knowing how much poverty there is in this country, how can you ethically kind of start to decide which marginalized groups are going to tackle first, without simply addressing the people who are most economically disenfranchised, who are disproportionately also people of color? You know, how do you manage that prioritization process? And are those trade-offs necessary? Can you kind of do both at the same time? And so there wasn't a direct answer on the question of should we have reparations. I think most people on the left broadly agree that there's a moral debt owed, and of course that this country participated in the enslavement and then subsequent de jure and de facto segregation and subjugation of groups of people. The more difficult questions are about implementation.
And we played the clips earlier of Bernie Sanders and then Julian Castro criticizing Sanders for suggesting reparations would take the form of a check, and that's probably not viable when, as Castro put it, Sanders is talking about writing checks for all kinds of things like Medicare for All and College for All.
I think that's a pretty disingenuous characterization, I have to say, because of course the Medicare for All plan is not a plan to write a check to every American for their health care bill, right? And it's certainly not a check to write a flat amount to every American for their health care bill. It's a substantive policy proposal, the likes of which we don't have in the context of reparations. And even Castro equivocated and didn't say whether he said, well, maybe I'm for a check or against a check. And it seems like a pretty, I don't know, somewhat bad faith characterization of his own beliefs in addition to Sanders.
Without saying what he's for. And there
right.
are some things that at least are partial reparations plans that I think we could say are policy proposals coming from some of the presidential candidates, like Kamala Harris has a kind of special tax credit, and Cory Booker has what he calls baby bonds. Are you familiar with both of those?
Well, both of those plans are great. Authority on reparations, Andy Darity, at Duke University, a professor there, has said that baby bonds is the program most targeted to close the wealth gap. However, neither of those programs are reparations in any traditional sense. They aren't programs that are aimed at targeting African Americans specifically, and they aren't recompense for the harms of slavery and subsequent discrimination. They are plans that are anti-poverty plans. Plans that are generalized and will benefit white Americans and Americans of all colors as well. So I think the idea that you can slap the name reparations on these programs, which are otherwise good, isn't accurate. And moreover, if we're going to do that, then obviously, you know, Senator Sanders, who's been leading kind of the vanguard for years about closing the wealth gap, more generally speaking, could be said then to have the best reparations plan, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not been the game we've been playing thus far. And on some level, it almost feels like Sanders is being the most honest by saying, I have plans to close the wealth gap, but because they aren't specifically exclusively going to the benefit of African Americans, I don't think it's fair to call them reparations. These others seem to be wanting to co-opt a movement around genuine reparations and this, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates style reckoning that the country should do with the specific harms that it's inflicted upon African Americans. Take that movement and that energy around that and co-opt it for kind of political branding purposes.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Lynn calling from Michigan. Lynn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you very much. When I married my Indian husband in the 1970s, a mixed marriage, there was not any tensions between Indians and whites in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin. We lived in northern Wisconsin during the 1980s when Indians were suing for their rights under the 1842 treaty to hunt and fish. And to be treating, which it was supposed to be a legal issue, but it was presented as a racial issue. And it created a kind of a race war. I don't think we had actual casualties besides fist fights, but it certainly had a horrible psychological impact on my daughter.
Lynn, it sounds like a horrible story for your family as well as for northern Minnesota in particular, but forgive me for time purposes. Bring us to the relevance to the debate over reparations.
With a bumper sticker on the cars that said, kill an Indian, save a walleye. And I think reparations would create the worst racial tension that we could imagine.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. What about that critique, Brianna?
You know, I think what's interesting is... the thing that I think is the more legitimate criticism of Sanders here is that he has worked to shift the Overton window on issues like Medicare for All, right? But we don't have majorities supporting Medicare for All today because he showed up in 2016 and snapped his fingers and said Medicare for All and everybody cheered. He's been kind of working around the clock for the last 3 years, doing town halls around the country, popularizing the idea so that it went from about 50% popularity to something like 70 in the low 70s, I think, popularity today, right? So I think that what you get backlash when you haven't done the work to reframe the issue and take your case to the American people. And I do think, look, reparations is not an overwhelmingly popular idea. Barely, I think a little over half, maybe 60% of African Americans support it. So it's not overwhelmingly popular even among the group it's targeted to benefit, right? But I do think that there is a world where if people were better educated about the historical rationale behind reparations, and if it were framed in various, depending on how it's framed, it could go over better. I actually think that the tort law claim for reparations is arguably a better case because it takes it away from a place where you're saying, I'm going to sue, like basically white Americans have to pay for what ancestors did, some of whom, you know, some of whom immigrated to this country after a lot of the trauma that reparations are supposed to be compensating for was mm-hmm. over. Instead saying, here are the corporations that did X, Y, and Z. Here's how the government played a direct role in disenfranchising citizens. And that perhaps that kind of framing would go over better because people would feel less victimized. White Americans would feel less targeted. And also because it would be part of a process of educating people about the historical causality and would change their mind about how much reparations were actually deserved.
And I think we're going to have a caller next with a story that kind of helps set a precedent, and that's Stephanie in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Brian. Thanks very much. My knowledge is very sketchy, but it's through a family member. I have a cousin by marriage who was born in a displaced persons camp in the years directly after World War II in Europe. Her family was brought to Boston. She was still really a baby. She doesn't remember those years. Her earliest memories are of growing up in Boston, nice American girl, and so forth. But she talked about the fact that her family did receive reparations after World War II. And I think Bernie's question is very, very much on point, not against it, but what are you actually talking about? Her recollection is that her family received reparations, and she had her two parents and siblings, from the time, you know, again, they were in the DP camp until they probably about at least 10 years, 15 years, maybe even up to 20 years. I don't know how long it was, mm-hmm. but it was not for the full life of the family, and the family was expected at some point, you know, to take hold. And that is what happens, as I understand it. Her father, you know, and her parents took hold, and they, you know, had a right. normal, what you would consider middle class, good, solid middle class life.
And Stephanie, I'm going to jump in there for time, but your story is very telling, and I think the point is very clear. And I guess, Brianna, the question becomes, how much can the precedent of Jews and others in Europe after World War II getting cash reparations, some Japanese Americans after the internment camps, mm-hmm. also of World War II, mm-hmm. politically be used as a kind of precedent that could sell this widely?
I think it's absolutely relevant precedent. But there are people who raise the argument, well, nobody who was enslaved is alive. And to that, I would respond two ways. I'd say first that the movement for reparations started long before the last slave died. And that basically by kicking the can down the road, the people who would oppose reparations have positioned themselves to be able to rely on that excuse. And in no like legal context would you be able to intentionally, get the statute of limitations to expire and then use that as an excuse to say that a claim is barred, right? So I don't think that that is fair, besides which there have been cases in the context of survivors of the Holocaust in particular where descendants, I think also with Japanese interned Japanese Americans, that their survivors and families were able to receive reparations if the immediate person who suffered the harm had already passed away. I'd also say that reparations is not just for slavery. It's for redlining. It's for segregation. It's for myriad policies that stretched well into the middle of this century. And as my mother likes to say, who was born in 1960, I was born into a country without civil rights, you know. And there are myriad, millions of Black Americans who were born before the Civil Rights Act and whose offspring suffer the consequences of not having that full citizenship, right, and full participation in American society.
And that's part of what was so central to Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay in The Atlantic a few mm-hmm. years ago, which I think everybody should read, The Case for Reparations. Mm-hmm. So much of the economic harm that's so much more recent than slavery and with repercussions in so many families' lives today. We're out of time, but I don't know if you saw, if you had time with all your work at South by Southwest over the weekend, but David Brooks, the conservative columnist in the New York Times, came out with a column this weekend that said he's reconsidered his position on reparations and he now thinks it's a moral necessity. So we leave
it
there.
That's that Overton window shifting.
Brianna Gray, political director for The Intercept, joining us live from South by Southwest, where she interviewed AOC on stage yesterday. Thank you so much. We'll talk again.
Thank you.